Hi, I'm Connor Friedersdorf, a staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine.
And I am Phoebe Connolly, senior editor at Yahoo News.
And you're at South by Southwest in Austin, is that right?
I am, in fact. You will see when you get to enjoy this video that I am actually up on the fourth floor of the Austin Convention Center.
All right. And for those who don't know, tell us, what is South by Southwest and what are you doing there?
So South by Southwest is a series of three festivals. There's music, film, and interactive. I'm actually here for interactive. And it's industry leaders and thinkers coming together to talk about what's happening in their world. So interactive has actually gotten big enough at this point that there's several different tracks. So there's people talking about venture capital. There's an entire track that's just about government and the way that it interacts with social. There's a journalism track, and I'm sure there's many others that I'm leaving out. And then they're all sort of tied together with keynotes that'll happen throughout the conference. And we're in day four, I believe, of the conference. I'm pretty sure it started Friday.
Okay, and am I right? I've never been. Am I right to imagine that it's almost a series of TED-style talks? Is that what it's like?
Some of them are like that. Actually, it's on the scale of conferences, we can talk about, you know, the good and the bad. I actually really love that Interactive has a mix. So some of them are full panels. I went to one yesterday that was headed by Alexa from TechCrunch. I'm actually blanking on her last name because she tweets under the handle Alexa. And so she is a journalist, and then she had a bunch of venture capitalists and people who had worked in the startup world. So it was five people on a panel. And then, actually, I'm hoping we'll talk about it later today. I went to a panel just a few minutes ago, which was just a solo panel, a woman who works for Lomography, which is an analog camera company. So it's a mix of panel-style things. Sometimes it's just conversations. Sometimes it's solo presentations.
Okay. Cool. So why don't you start us off with a topic. What's one of the interesting things that you've been hearing about or talking about there?
Well, I think the big thing, particularly from an online news and journalism standpoint that has come out of this, is this question of whether we need to be curating better. So it was funny. When I approached that panel, I was really thinking about it from the perspective of work that I had done at Yahoo, asking Yahoo readers to write in and share their stories. We have a series called Down But Not Out, where we curate, basically, reader stories of being unemployed. But it turns out that the panels here were really concerned about this whole question of aggregation. So what is the proper way to pull links from a story or excerpts from a story and write about it on another platform, which I think has been a very hot topic recently. We both know Kashmir Hill, who's a writer for Forbes, and she recently was sort of involved in this altercation with a New York Times writer over her use of taking some of his work and writing about it. She took what she thought was the most interesting part of the piece and just wrote about that and got a lot of page views off of it and also got a lot of heat for people who said she had done it incorrectly. So her name did not actually come up that I've heard, but it's certainly a conversation that's happening here. So the two things that came out of this, one, there's going to be an industry group that's going to come together. And if you're looking for a link, it'll be down at the bottom here. David Carr wrote really well about this today for the Times, that wants to put a set of standards in place for how you aggregate well. The idea being that if there's standards, then you know you agree to sign on to it. It's clear what's correct, what's not correct, how much is too much to take when you're aggregating. And also, I think, maybe more interestingly, a woman named Maria Popova from Brain Picking introduced two symbols that she wants people to be using when they're aggregating content. So one where you're just saying via, right? This is where I got this amazing cool thing that I found online. And then also one that indicates hat tip, where you're saying, here's why I saw this idea, but I'm also actually adding some value to it. I'm riffing off of this thing I saw elsewhere.
Okay. So yeah, this is fascinating to me for a few reasons. One is that I'm glad to see that this is happening. I think it's worth thinking about how we fairly attribute things, whether it's stuff that we aggregate or whether it's a bit in a news story or whatever the case may be. It's interesting to me that it's happening now, that the internet is inspiring it, because I don't think that this ever happened before in the days when broadcast news would just sort of steal at will from print journalists and say things on television, right? And I think that you know, I started out as a beat reporter at a local newspaper and certainly had the experience of local television stations and local radio stations as well. Just, you know, reading stories where I knew that they had gotten the reporting from me. It wasn't something that was, you know, breaking news where everyone would have covered it at that moment, and yet here they were with, you know, talking about this Enterprise story just the day after I published it. What a coincidence, right? And so I think that print journalists have been attuned to that and, you know, upset by it for a long time, and have kind of felt like the average TV and radio viewer doesn't realize how much of the information reported there comes from the world of print, or I guess now the world of digital words. And so it's interesting to me that it's happening now and that this is only coming up now. And I wonder what is different about the current aggregation environment that that is making it come up now.
You know, to be totally honest, a part of why I think it's coming up now is because legacy media, to use a loose catch-all term, is getting into the aggregation game. So they're not just doing the, you know, so to take the example, it's, well, I'm going to pick on The Atlantic for a second. Sorry, Connor. You know, but you guys have this history as a print publication, right? Very long, respected. But you've also introduced, which I love, the Atlantic Wire, which is very much a, you know, aggregate-y, linky, you know, here's cool things that are happening all over the web.
Right, yeah.
So I think that as organizations that didn't previously do aggregation have gotten into that game, it's made the issue sort of resurface in a way that I think people like you or I have been very aware of the pitfalls of this for a long time. But now suddenly...
Yeah.
Folks who previously would just write feature stories were like, oh, hey, that's really not okay when that happens to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, I guess I just think that the I do think that people are doing aggregation as an explicit thing now. You know, the Atlantic Wire is an explicit product that the Atlantic has put out that what we're doing there is aggregating the most interesting stuff and adding a little bit of commentary or a little bit of framing. Mm-hmm. And so that is new, and it's certainly something that The Atlantic never did in its magazine days, especially insofar as it was writing, you know, long-form commissioned features in its print pages. You know, at the same time, I think that the New York Times, to take an example, they may not put it this way, but they've been aggregating for a long time, right? For a long time, the way that the New York Times worked was that they did a lot of original reporting, but they also had, you know, people in different regions all over the United States and in different countries all over the world, and they would read the local press, and they would write about it. And they wouldn't always do a good job of crediting the local reporters that were the sort of grist for the stories that they then reported further or that they followed up on or whatever. And so, you know, I guess the Keshbir Hill story that you were talking about, where she basically took a New York Times magazine story and pulled out a couple of chunks and added commentary and wrote a headline that drew a lot more attention than the original magazine headline. And to me, this is an unmitigated good for the writer of the New York Times piece and for the New York Times. It seems to me that they got a bunch more traffic, they got a bunch more attention because of her story than they otherwise would have gotten, and I can't see how she hurt them in any way. I understand.
I also think her example is really interesting because, I mean, listen, the New York Times piece was a fascinating portrait, but the real value added that she did is she said, listen, I know that there is a constituency who is interested in this chunk of this piece, right?
Right.
And that's not how the Times is going to sell it, right? Because that's not how it makes sense to package it for the New York Times magazine. Our readership would not be interested in that story. And she said, but I know that there's a constituency who is interested in just this piece of this story.
Yeah, and if I'm recalling correctly, the story was about Target using sort of all of the data that it collects from people coming into its stores in order to better sell them things in all sorts of different ways. And the chunk that Kashmir picked out was that Target, by looking at the buying patterns of women in its stores, were able to determine when a woman was likely to be pregnant and send her coupons. And the idea behind this was that, I guess, when you have a new child, your buying patterns, it is one of the periods in your life when your buying patterns are likely to shift, when you're likely to be open to try new brands and different kinds of products. And I think Cashmere's headline was something to the, what was it? It was how Target knows it's pregnant before... before you do, or but anyway, the anecdote in the story was that this woman got these coupons sent to her house, and her father found them and got mad at Target and said, "How? Why are you sending my relatively young daughter coupons about pregnancy?" And it turned out that the daughter was actually pregnant. The father
pregnant,
just didn't
right.
know it yet. And so yeah, so Cashmere found this constituency that would be interested in this and packaged it and sort of sold it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're absolutely right about that. I just don't get why. I mean, as someone tweeted, I don't know whose line I'm stealing, but it was basically, please Cashmere, if you could do this to all of my stories.
Yeah, right.
If you could just repackage them in a way that generates tons more readers and attention, you know, please do.
I do think there's a really interesting point there that you, and this actually kind of brings us full circle, right? That part of what felt so problematic, I would guess, for those who critiqued her, right? I'm not one of them. I thought it was sort of a great use of what we all do, right?
Yeah.
But just the fact that she was competing in the same space now as the New York Times Magazine. They're both
right.
online. It's not, she wasn't just doing this for broadcast. She wasn't just doing this. So that the fact that the New York Times Magazine considers online to be its domain, it's no longer something that's just separate and off in the world.
Right.
So, the internet.
You know,
we're all on the internet now.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the kind of curating that I think is more objectionable is, it's been a while since I've paid close attention while reading a Gawker post, but my sense, at least at some point, and maybe this is still the case, is that they would sort of write a post about something, and the link would be kind of buried at the very foot of the post.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that rubs me the wrong way. To me, it is better to link and make it easy on the reader to go to the second source if they're inclined to do so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been involved in a lot of different.
Although I will say, in the defense of that, one of the things that I love that I associated a lot with Jezebel, I don't know if it was cross property, was when they would take a piece that sort of talked about a couple of different articles they had seen online or some sort of trends that had been discussed widely, at the bottom they would link to all of them, and I just found that great, right? Like, I didn't have to go and hunt for the links within the stories. It was like, as I saw them, I could always scroll down to the bottom and be like, here's everything that was discussed in this piece. Which actually reminds me a lot of, isn't that the New York Review of Books that will say sort of like discussed in this essay and it'll be at the very top? Am I dating myself?
Yeah, they definitely do that.
I mean, like, back when I had a subscription to the New York
Review. Yeah, the New York Review of Books, they'll do that even with web pieces. They'll treat it like a book review. And they'll say, we're discussing these articles in the same way that they would normally say we're discussing these books at the top.
Which I really like.
And, you know, I guess
although you will, I mean, just this sort of point Connor, right? Like, they always put that at the top. It's not at the bottom.
Right. But yeah, so, you know, I guess I've seen a bunch of different aggregation models. I saw the development side when they were talking about doing The Wire at The Atlantic and, of course, worked with Andrew Sullivan, who has his own method of sort of aggregation and attribution and linking that's grown up organically over the years, like most of the blogosphere where the term hat tip came from. And I do this aggregation project of my own called The Best of Journalism that's sort of just a weekly digest of really good stuff to read. And it's usually, I send out an email twice a week, and it's three stories in each email, and people pay, I think it's $1.99 a month to get it. And so there are all these different models of aggregation, some of which add a lot of original stuff, some of which add not much original stuff. But as someone who really likes long-form journalism, really wants to see it thrive, I think that aggregation is a really good thing for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that, I just found as a reader, as someone who has read a lot of bloggers over the years, there's a certain mental hurdle that you have to get over to read a 15,000-word magazine article.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit intimidating. If you see it in print, it's a little bit intimidating. If you see the little bar on the right side of your browser, very small, and you see that you'll have a long way to pull it down in order to finish an article, it's kind of intimidating. And how do you get over that initial hurdle? I think one of the ways that people get over that initial hurdle is reading someone that they like and having that person do a smaller take on it. Because I can read an Andrew Sullivan post, or I can read something by Kashmir, and I can read it in 2 or 3 minutes, and if it's interesting, it's almost doing the same job that a headline and subhead does on a magazine story.
That's right.
It's saying, you know, I'm going to interest you in this angle that I know you're going to be interested in, that I know you, someone who likes things through the lens of Andrew Sullivan, is going to be interested in. And once you get over that hurdle, I find it's a lot easier to read the longer piece because
it's sort of that style of like recommending a book, right? You know, that when you have a novel, if you have someone be like, hey, here's why I liked it, here's this scene, here's this character that it captures, here's this reason to otherwise delve into a much longer narrative, that it's doing that work for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things, so in the New York Times article on aggregation and the ethics of it, I guess, or the courtesy aspect of it, there was a woman who has a Twitter account where she basically hunts things, interesting things down on the internet. I didn't follow her before, actually. I added her after this. But my sense is that she's kind of a Twitter equivalent of someone like Jason Kotke, who just hunts down the most obscure, fascinating stuff.
Or have you ever checked out Codal Partners?
I have not.
They're a design firm out of Chicago that similarly will just, and it's just literally like one lines and clicks, and it's funny that I'll see stuff there. I'd followed them for years because they were Chicago-based. Mm-hmm. And then I'll see it like 2 weeks later, it's sort of filtered up through the ecosystem.
Yeah, and so to me, one of the trickiest questions is what's the fair way to credit those people?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like they're finding stuff someplace too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're doing this service to the rest of us who can rely on them for I guess reliably coming up with interesting stuff. And I don't quite know. I mean, I try in my own work, I usually try to hat tip people when I come across something that I wouldn't have seen on my own otherwise. So, you know, if I'm reading a blog like Outside the Beltway, say, and I see a New York Times article there, and I just happen to see it at Outside the Beltway first, I won't hat tip for that. I read the New York Times too. It's sort of out there and widely available and widely known. What I will hat tip is where I see, oh, a link to a really interesting essay by an obscure blogger, and I would never have seen that if someone at Outside the Beltway hadn't linked that. And then I'll hat tip. And I don't really know if that's I haven't thought a ton about that. It's just,
you know,
kind of
that seems valid
operate.
To me. I just think that there's also sort of an added responsibility then, if you're seeing people who particularly are coming up in the industry who are doing that work, that you are you're pointing other people to them. You're saying, you know, here, you need to be paying attention to this person in general because they're surfacing information for me that maybe I would have found elsewhere. But in general, they're a good person to know and to follow. You know, and I think that's about kind of creating, you know, nurturing the ecosystem that brought all of us up, right?
Right. Yeah, and also another interesting question that comes up here is how do we treat, does it matter if people are in the aggregation business? In other words, sometimes I come across something from an aggregator, from Real Clear Politics or from Jason
Or Memorandum or Tech Meme. Those are both.
It is.
I love both of them.
And yeah, and but then other times you come across something interesting on your high school friend's Facebook page, or on the Twitter account of someone you know that is not a public Twitter account, right? And so how do we
doesn't that feel a little
like
different though, right? Like that's much more like us acting as reporters out in the world, and you know, the same way that you would want to, if you came upon a story idea, you would actually report that out further. Be like, listen, my social circle, the people at my coffee shop every morning are really interested in, the new iPad, right? They're all going to buy it now because of what have you. That would be something you would sort of like report out and talk about, because what's interesting is the setting in which you encountered it. That feels inherently different to me than saying, than taking that work from someone else who's already working in that field. Right? Like,
yeah, I think it feels different too, but the question is sort of, it gets at the question of what we're trying to do when we attribute things. One theory of what we're trying to do might be we're trying to be transparent, or we're trying to give credit where it originates, or we're trying to give readers an idea of where this came from. Another theory is we're trying to reward good aggregation so that more of it exists. And I think the way you go about doing things changes in various ways depending on which one of those aims you're. So yeah, it seems to me that the aim you have in mind when you're tipping people off to where something came from matters. You know, one aim might be, I want to be transparent with my readers. I want to let them know where this came from. I want them to be able to trace it back. Another aim might be, I want good aggregators to exist, and so I want to credit them for their work because I want them to have an incentive to do this.
I see that. I'm not sure that you can necessarily separate out those two things, right? That part of letting people know where you got it is saying, I want good aggregation to continue to exist.
Yeah, I think that's right. But there are some cases where I got it from my mom, or I got it from my high school friend's Facebook page.
Well, right, but I think that's the distinction, right? That like those people are not trying to be aggregators. So that's much more of
right,
like...
Right, but you would still cite them if what you cared about was letting people trace things back or giving them an idea of where it came from or whatever.
Fair, but it seems inherently different than the type of aggregation where you're recognizing people who are also doing this as a business. Your mom is not aggregating as a business. Well, maybe she is. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that that's right. It is different. And yet there are blurry lines, right? Because there are people who... aren't doing it as a business, but who are at the same time very good at it. I mean, like, for example, back when there was Google Reader and now on Google Plus, my fiance Courtney aggregates a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. And she's someone who doesn't blog professionally, isn't a professional journalist. She has her own, very successful career. At the same time, she was an early blogger in the early days of the internet, and has a bunch of journalist friends, and is very attuned to this kind of thing. She mm-hmm. she could do it professionally, I would say.
Isn't the distinction there that she has made an internet presence for herself? Right? She has blogged. I have no idea. Is her Twitter feed locked or unlocked?
I think it is unlocked. I'm not sure, though.
Talk about us being bad journalists. We don't even know about these people we're talking about. Right, but if she was someone who has created a public internet persona for herself...
Right,
that's a little different. But I do think that... I don't know that it changes for me if it's her versus... when I've written at Yahoo about people who have pulled into the election, right? So they had their question pulled on CNN or... and actually, that's a great example, right? So I wrote this post about this guy. I think his name is Michael Brown, but his Twitter handle is MichaelBrown11. And first CNN-sponsored debate, they pulled his question and they said, here's Michael Brown on SOPA. And I wrote about sort of like, he ended up over the course of the evening getting 22 new followers. But it was important to me, I think, both for CNN in being transparent about where this question lived on Twitter, but also just for him as someone who is engaging in this public conversation, that it be cited and it go back to his name.
Yeah. Yeah.
To your point, I'm not sure that it changes. I think it's still incumbent on us as people who are on the internet to attribute at all times.
Yeah, I will be curious to see what the I forget the name, the working group of official-sounding journalists comes up with on this.
They should go by that title, the working group of official-sounding journalists.
So they should, yes. So you're telling me about another interesting thing at South by Southwest, something about homeless hotspots. What is that about?
Yes, I mean, and I should say that I find it hugely problematic before I start telling you the story, but there is a marketing group. It's a global ad agency called BBH, and they have a sort of spin-off firm, which is BBH Labs, right, that does sort of viral marketing for them. And one of their projects here in Austin is they have hired people who are homeless to walk around, and they have kitted them out with hotspots, and you can walk up to them and either via PayPal or via cash pay to connect to the internet. And the part of what I think was so sort of disconcerting to people when they saw them is that the marketing is very much tied up in their status as being someone who is homeless. So their shirts say, "Hi, my name is Mike," or "My name is Sean. I'm a homeless hotspot." And so that has been sort of floating around. And actually, Tim Carmody at Wired did some digging into this. And one of the things that tipped his balance towards being even more problematic is once he had looked into this firm, he found that this was not the first time that they had done viral marketing efforts around people who were homeless. They did a project earlier where they had, and it was actually a group of interns, had worked with some people who were homeless and given them cell phones and gotten them connected digitally for 3 months and sort of allowed them to connect to the world and then kind of tracked this and followed this and wrote about this. And he wrote on Wired about the fact that it seems like their sort of end result was going to be to create a reality television show as opposed to trying to make any material difference in these men's lives. And also, their connectivity was cut off after those 3 months. So it wasn't like, here's a cell phone. It was like, here's a cell phone for 3 months, and then now you don't have it anymore.
Right.
And I actually realized that I had written about the same group because they also launched a project last summer where they were trying to raise awareness around various social causes, as they termed them. And they were not paying people. They were allowing people on the internet to force a hashtag to trend on Twitter, and then they had volunteers agree to get that hashtag tattooed on their body to raise awareness around Haiti, Japan, various places where natural disasters had occurred.
Wait, so the idea that someone was going to tattoo the hashtag if it got enough play was enough to inspire people to use the hashtag on Twitter?
That was the project, yes. At the time, I really thought it was limited by the fact that they didn't, for example, link in any of the product materials to charities that were actually doing work materially in these regions that had been devastated by natural disasters. So it seemed a little bit like a closed internet loop where we're going to talk about it on the internet and then we're going to get a tattoo off of it. But as far as actually getting involved in the cause, that didn't exist as part of the project. So yes, I don't know.
So yeah,
your reactions, your thoughts?
Well, this also reminds me, there's definitely a strain of homeless exploitation projects in the culture, and I don't know quite why. I was thinking when you were talking about this about that video that someone made called Bum Fight. Did you hear about this?
Did.
And it was basically that a guy went around paying bums to fight each other, and then I forget if he was selling it as trying to sell a reality show or selling it as direct videos on the internet. Obviously an awful project and one that I think he eventually got in legal trouble for. I don't quite understand. I don't want to compare that to homeless hotspots. I think that clearly a huge difference. It definitely gets at this question of to what extent are homeless people, to what extent should we treat them like other economic actors, I guess. I certainly have an impulse to be more paternalistic about homeless people than I am about other people. There is a there's a little, I mean, for example, generally I'm in favor of the government giving poor people cash to spend on stuff rather than subsidizing stuff through, you know, food stamps or vouchers or whatever. I'm generally not in favor of being overly paternalistic about these things. When it comes to homeless people, I think it's partly that at this point, in a lot of places, certainly not every place, but in a lot of places, there are enough resources for people to get off the street if they want to, and that it's mental illness that's keeping a lot of people on the streets. Where I have recently been subletting in Laguna Beach, there is a decent-sized homeless population, partly because it's lovely and you can sleep on the beach, and partly because it's in Orange County, it is a generally liberal, kind of artsy, bohemian place that has attracted homeless people for the same reason that in L.A. they're attracted to Venice. And you talk to people who work with the homeless, and they'll encourage you to never, ever give homeless people money on the street. And Laguna actually has this program where they have put old parking meters at a couple of places right near the beach with a little sign on them that says, don't give your change to the homeless, put it in here, and this goes to a homeless charity. I don't know. I think this is a problem, really, that no one has resolved, and I guess I don't know how I feel about homeless hotspots. I'm kind of torn between the rare paternalistic side of me and the side that thinks, well, I don't know. I mean, people aren't we haven't dedicated enough resources to the homeless problem that it's gone away.
I guess
so. Maybe we can't rely on people's
right. But I think there's something really different there, right? Like there is getting involved, right? There's a very complicated discussion to be had about. Well, not necessarily complicated, but you know, rich and a lot of points to bring up about how to actually address homelessness. And I certainly would say I'm definitely not an expert in this, but from this particular project, I think it's problematic because you're not giving them any agency. You're not actually sort of addressing this, which I think you and I would agree is a problem, right? Not having a house is a problem. That is a...
Right.
But you're just taking advantage of that. You're turning it into your brand. You're turning it into something that you market off of, as opposed to giving these people any agency to change that or helping them address that in whatever form that may be.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it gets down to... So I guess that...
And just actually, if I can cycle this back around, I mean, this is part of why I was suddenly really... I was like, oh, why? I'm not at all surprised that these are the same people who thought that an appropriate way to raise awareness or help with this charity cause of Haiti or the tsunami in Japan is by having it trend on Twitter and getting tattoos. I mean, that doesn't... You're churning the waters, right? You're creating a buzzy talked about project. I mean, I found out about that project because it went out on Mashable last August. But ultimately, you're not actually doing anything about the actual problem that you have, you know, sucked into your marketing and branding effort.
Right. Yeah. I definitely
see. And you know, it's not just like, hey, we're doing this thing where we are employing people who are living on the streets in Austin as part of South by Southwest, right? No, what they're doing is they're saying we're taking their status as being homeless individuals and we're turning that into our brand. We're saying, oh, you're homeless. Well, now you'll be a homeless hotspot. Like that's to me what really becomes problematic and dehumanizing.
But wait, so are they compensated in any way?
Yes, they're getting some of the payments. I don't know if it's a proportion of the payment or the full payment that you make when you pay for the mobile hotspot.
Okay, got it. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it seems to me that in the mobile hotspot case, I mean, I think it says something about us as a society that that altruism is insufficient to help the homeless. But I think it's true that altruism is insufficient to help the homeless. And so, you know, I mean, I would not feel good about having a marketing agency that did this project. At the same time, it seems like it probably leaves the homeless people better off. than they were before, or at least doesn't leave them worse off and makes some of them better off. I don't know. I would be curious to talk to them 5 months from now, you know, and ask them, was this something that helped you get a little bit of money and, you know, turn it into a shopping cart store a la Bubs in the Wire, or was this something where, you know, it made you worse off for some reason? I don't know.
Right, and maybe that's what is making me so uncomfortable, is that I do feel like the lines between sort of something that's altruistic and something that is just commercial are really being blurred.
Definitely. I guess to play devil's advocate on your point that this marketing agency is using these people's status instead of doing something instead of some alternative. You know, certainly there are alternatives where the homeless would be better off. But, you know, we don't expect marketing agencies to go and do charitable things. If a marketing agency had never engaged in any charity in its life, we wouldn't typically hold that against them or hold them up to ridicule for that. To me, the creepy part of it is that it isn't the treatment of the homeless now that I think about it. That's the creepy part to me. To me, the creepy part is that it is playing off of this society-wide weird relationship and fascination with homelessness that I think is some of the same impulse behind bum fights. And so I think it's like the larger culture surrounding it that bothers me. And to the extent that this is sort of drawing on that culture, I share your intuition that it's sort of creepy. But another side of me thinks that that creepiness in the culture is a given, and that at least while playing on that creepiness, that this makes the people better off, maybe. I don't know. I'd have to think about this more to come to a really solid conclusion, but that's at least my initial thought.
I'm with you. Hey, Connor, let's pause one.
So another subject I wanted to talk about, the obituary. Andrew Breitbart died recently and was, of course, a very controversial figure, and I think partly because he died at such a young age. I think he was 41, definitely in his early 40s.
Yeah.
It really surprised a lot of people. His family was, of course, devastated, and his friends, which he had many in the media, were very upset. And it sort of restarted this conversation about how should we treat people, especially controversial people, when they die? Should their obituaries be hostile if you generally felt like they had a negative influence on public life? Should they be respectful? Should you not talk ill of the dead, as it is sometimes said? Christopher Hitchens, of course, was famous for writing hostile obituaries, and Kitty Roifey recently wrote a piece that we'll link, I think, on Slate, talking about how she was tired of the trend toward hostile obituaries, and that maybe we shouldn't speak ill of the dead. And people have gone back and forth on this. I wrote a piece. I've tangled with Breitbart for several years, and we definitely saw the role of journalists and pundits very differently. And I wrote an obituary. I wrote a piece the day that he died that argued that we ought to be focusing in the immediate aftermath of his death on the positive things that he did, and then at the same time we should revisit his legacy. And I went back and did another quite lengthy post about that. One thing I did in both of those pieces was to point out that he was widely said to be a very dedicated father to his four kids and to be a very good husband to his wife. And this is something that that just came up again and again in other things that people wrote about him after he died. And I thought that was worth mentioning. A lot of commenters at The Atlantic didn't like that and said that Breitbart is only famous for his public behavior, that you could say about anyone after they died that they were a good husband or a wife or that their kids won another.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's true, that you could probably say that about anyone after they died, but I kind of think that the double standard should be resolved in the other direction, that it would be a good thing if more, quote-unquote, regular or non-famous people made it into the obituaries that we didn't...
That you've didn't unpacked so much already. Hold on. Let's back up and get to your original... Let's start, because I...
Yeah, please, jump in.
I don't know that I almost feel like I would want that to leave that decision in the hands of whoever was writing the obituary. Right? That's a very... how you memorialize those who have passed and what you... Because ultimately that's a remembrance, right? That's your remembering. That's your saying, here's what I... You know, and even if it's things that you have recently learned in the process of writing that, if you're writing it sort of as like a public figure, you know, obviously you're not a professional obituary writer. You're writing sort of more of a remembrance. I guess I would feel uneasy saying that that would be a line I would want to draw for you, right? That would be something I would want to say, no, that's your writing, that's you remembering this person, and that should be your sort of place to talk about it, or not talk about it, right? So obviously the way that you conceived of Breitbart was in part this relationship he had with his children and his family.
Yeah, well, I guess I just think that I take the point that it's broadly true of people that, you know, they had good qualities. They had some good qualities in their private life, right? But I don't think that the fact that it's broadly true means that it should be written out of public remembrances. And I think that the way that obituaries are generally written treats someone's professional life as though it is more important than their personal life.
And right, but I mean, that's also generally why you would know them, right? Like, I don't know Andrew Breitbart because he had, you know, four kids that he had a fantastic relationship with, or that he went to every softball game. I mean, that's just not why I know him. Those may be totally true things about him, and I, you know, in reading an obituary, if that is something that you, having studied his life, feel is important to include, absolutely, but... You know, that's part of our job is the news, right? And the news of Andrew Breitbart's death, when you're explaining him as a media figure, as someone who is known, you're going to do that through the lens of the political controversies that he was very much a part of, that he made his career and made the reason why his name was known.
Yeah. I think part of the reason why I'm thinking about this so much, I've been at work on a biography of one of the founders of SeaWorld.
That's great.
It's made me very attuned to, I mean, you know, being one of the founders of SeaWorld, right? It's a very recognizable thing that you can tell anyone, and they'll think, oh, well, I understand why this guy is important. And, you know, writing about his life, I've interviewed his kids, and I have talked to his grandkids, and given that he had three kids and a bunch of grandkids, it seems pretty clear to me when I think about it that his impact on the world probably had more of an impact through his kids and the way that he raised him than he did himself, which isn't to say that, you know, he wasn't, by all accounts, a very successful entrepreneur, and he also was a very successful soldier. He fought in World War II and won a Silver Star and a Bronze Star. And I just think taking the measure of his life and really thinking about it, he's someone who... maybe unlike some people, took a very self-conscious and deliberate approach to the way he raised his kids and the values that he wanted to inculcate, and I can see that in all of them and see the ways that they have contributed to the world. I don't know, it just got me thinking that, in the process of thinking, like, you know, how do I write about this man's life? How do I sort of capture the important things about it? It got me thinking about the way that people have a tremendous impact on their kids, on their friends. I think these things are, we don't always think to even ask about them if we're writing an obituary. You know, if a beat reporter in a newspaper is told, oh, this important person in the community died, go and, you know, interview the widow. You don't always think to ask about the non-professional things, the unexpected things. And I think that especially in America, we tend to focus on people's careers, and we tend to focus on, I think we tend to elevate those things, and certainly they're a big part of why we write about people and should stay that way. I just think they're not the only part, and we should remember that.
So to spin off of what you were saying, I think that it actually kind of links, sort of, maybe this is a slight jump, this idea of, like, do you focus on the personal or do you focus on the professional? With this essay that Jonathan Franzen recently wrote in The New Yorker about Edith Wharton. Did you have a chance to read that?
No, I haven't.
So Edith Wharton is one of my favorite novelists. I just think she's really super fantastic. And Jonathan Franzen wrote an introduction to three of her New York novels were recently re-released by, I think, Penguin Press. And in this introduction, which is also the New Yorker piece, he spins her entire professional life through this idea that she was an unattractive woman. Which I think is sort of taking... It's sort of the, like, wrong way of taking your point, right? So you're sort of, I think, you know, convincingly arguing that to consider someone's professional success, you should look at their personal life.
Right.
And here's this example of someone who did this, right, who said, well, if you look at her as this unattractive woman who had a not very successful marriage that, you know, maybe she ended up in, sort of posits this because, you know, she wasn't a beauty, that factors into the novels that she ended up writing.
Right.
Which I and a lot of other people just found to be a really unconvincing read on her work. So I guess, how do you react to that, right? Where sometimes you take the personal and you use it as a lens through which to understand someone's professional life, and it doesn't. And if in some ways it detracts from them as a professional actor.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't recommend, I certainly don't recommend every, you know, every possible interpretation you might have of how someone's personal life affected their professional life. And I should also say that looking at someone's personal life, you know, I've been spinning it in a positive way. It's not necessarily going to be positive. You know, maybe there's someone who's like a very successful scientist who beat his kid who went on to become a serial killer. I just think if we're assessing someone's impact on the world, the personal matters. But I am willing to believe that it was done poorly in this review that you're talking about.
So, I don't know. I mean, which is just, I think it ends up taking us to the end point, which is just that you have to be careful when you try to draw lines between someone's personal and professional and how those two are connected, right? That it may appear one way to you as an observer or to you as the biographer, but whether that's the truth of the matter, I think, just isn't always clear.
Yeah, I think maybe the conclusion to draw is that you can talk about someone's personal life, you can talk about the professional life. Trying to draw a line from one to the other can be very tricky. I think
right.
An example of this that maybe is a little bit better, I talked to Mark Oppenheimer a couple weeks ago on Blogging Heads, and he wrote a profile of Maggie Gallagher, the anti-gay marriage activist. And in the course of doing it, talked about why she was inspired to come to this sort of activism. And it was partly the fact that when she was in college, she got pregnant and had a kid and didn't end up marrying the father who ultimately decided he didn't want to be part of their life. And this was part of the reason why she came to conservatism and part of why she thought that traditional marriage was important. And anyway, he makes a kind of long case for why this was relevant. And in that case, you know, I think that it was. But I kind of like what you were saying earlier, that maybe there should be no standard biography. Maybe there's room for the Hitchens biography. There's room for the Hitchens obituary, and there's room for the opposite and everything in between. And we're better off having the full richness. There's no one right way to do it.
Right, and that I think skillful writing about someone else's life is to say that you take those moments that are disparate, but that actually paint this beautiful picture as a whole. I wrote a piece for The All when Elizabeth Taylor died, and I ended up pulling, I'm interested in her because she has this tremendous place in the history of AIDS activism where she really helped make it an acceptable mainstream cause.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that was what I spent the bulk of the time writing about, but there's this amazing profile, and I'll dig it up, that I think Roger Ebert had interviewed her very early on in her career. And he has this beautiful scene where she's in the dressing room and she's polishing this sapphire on the hem of her skirt, this, like, enormous sapphire. And I loved that, and I included it in the piece, right? And does it tell the whole story about Elizabeth Taylor? No, right? But the idea that this woman, you know, who is a female actress in Hollywood, picked up HIV and AIDS, made it a cause that was safe to raise money around, mm-hmm. could also be this, you know, frivolous woman who would stand there, like, polishing her huge jewels on the hem of her skirt. To me, like, is this picture of, like, the contradictions inherent in all of us.
Right.
And so I think that that's when drawing these moments from your personal, someone's personal life and someone's professional, you know, career or public life can really present a more nuanced, beautiful version of how we understand our lives.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. So there's one last thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
That's been on my mind. I don't know if you'll have a take on it or not. But so there's been this big controversy lately in the media about Rush Limbaugh and Sandra Fluke, and this is the woman that he called, quote, slut and prostitute after she testified about contraception. She argued that contraception should be available to law students and that if they didn't get it through their health plan, it would cost up to $3,000 for the time that they were in law school, and this was a tremendous expense. It was one of these media firestorms where someone says something that lots of people regard as offensive, and if they're, you know, Rush Limbaugh started losing sponsors over it, and there's this sort of ritual apology that he made that you often see in these cases where it seems like the deal is, it's like, all right, if you want this to go away, you're going to have to apologize. Seems to be the basic cultural message that we send. And he came out and apologized, maybe because he was tired of losing sponsors, maybe because he was genuinely sorry, I don't know. But it got me thinking, you know, I as a longtime critic of Rush Limbaugh, was not particularly satisfied with his apology. I think a lot of people, other people weren't either. But it got me thinking that maybe I wasn't satisfied because an apology isn't actually what I want in these sort of cases. And I thought, what if instead of demanding apologies in these cases, what was demanded of public figures is that they sort of sit down with someone who thinks differently than them, with one of their critics, and I thought Rachel Maddow would be a good person in this case. And they were just forced to sort of debate that other person and sort of defend their statements over the years and sort of, you know, whether they, in that debate, of course, they could apologize and back away from things, but really kind of sit down and be scrutinized and be challenged and be forced to sort of defend their approach to public life. And I personally would be a lot more satisfied with that model, that we demand that you we demand that you debate someone, then we demand that you apologize. It would make me personally happier.
Well, you do hit on something that I think is kind of underlooked right there, is that he, by apologizing, he's still occupying that media space, that public space, and it's him talking, as opposed to giving airtime to somebody who is saying something that was less offensive or less problematic or, you know, I came at it from a. Sorry about that, Connor. All right, so wait. Agree or disagree with sort of what his position is, right? Part of what's problematic is that he was talking about this woman's character in a very public way, right? That no one else, right, had that same sort of air, you know, bandwidth or space that was talking about her in a different way, mm-hmm. and that's part of what your debate would solve.
Well, I think, so, one, I think a lot of people that get caught in these I need to apologize positions, right? I mean, every once in a while it's someone who uncharacteristically says something offensive, and I don't really need a debate to happen in those cases, but I think a lot of the time it's someone who, the apology is being forced upon them precisely because there have been so many instances when people have been upset by what they've said, and it really motivates people to sort of go after them. And the way that people go after them in Rush Limbaugh's case was, at first, we demand you apologize. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they weren't satisfied with it, and you know, neither was I. But part of what I think is that it's sort of very easy to apologize. It's sort of very easy to go on your own radio show and to say, you know, I'm sorry for this, and to have a little statement written out and to read it and to be done with it. And if part of what we want to do is have actual contrition and also to have a disincentive to engage in this sort of bad rhetorical behavior, then much worse to have to defend your statements, right? And I also think
But isn't that just giving him more airtime? Like, he already has airtime.
So.
He already has a platform. I'm just not sure that, like, giving him more airtime to have to either defend his statement or walk back his statement. You know, and kind of, I'd be willing to say that maybe, you know, like, we're picking Rush Limbaugh as sort of an awkward example here, right? That maybe if you were talking about two people who weren't constantly out there speaking in the public eye, it would be sort of a different conversation. But in his case, actually just apologizing and then shutting up is, to me, the way to handle that situation, as opposed to giving him more airspace to continue to talk.
I mean, I never... people tell me this sometimes, you know, if I'll write an item on Rush Limbaugh, they say, oh, why are you paying attention to this guy? This is the wrong thing to do. He doesn't... It's a bad thing to elevate him and give him any more attention. I kind of think, you know, maybe that's true of someone, but this guy is the most popular talk radio host in America. He's got a huge audience listening to him for 3 hours.
But then shouldn't instead of, like, giving him more time to debate, like, if he has that huge audience, like, wouldn't the fitting punishment to his crime, right, if we agree that he needs to apologize and he needs to backtrack on that, be to, like, be forced to give some of that time over to someone else?
See, I think what I'm thinking is that it's almost a contradiction to say, you know, you forced someone to apologize. On some level, it doesn't make sense because you can't force contrition.
Right.
And so I think that apologies are mismatched to the task that we want them to serve. And I think what I want, actually, if I think about it more precisely, what I want is two things. I want Limbaugh, in this case, to have to confront the full implications of his ideas. And I want him to have to do it outside of the sort of hermetically sealed ideological bubble that he inhabits, where he gets to go on the radio and appear as if his ideas are a lot stronger than they are by having his finger on the hang-up button and the call screener and to really take colors and, you know, in all of these ways that he is able to get away with various things before his audience precisely because of the format that he's in, precisely because he's not challenged. You know, he could never successfully come on, you know, a television show or on Plugging Hens TV or on any sort of, you know, all sorts of different mediums, right, and be successful as he is at putting out ideas that don't stand up to scrutiny. And so I think what I would want from this debate is for both his audience and everyone else to see what happens when Rush Limbaugh is forced to operate outside the bubble, to see how his demeanor changes, to see how his arguments are pushed back against, to see the holes in his reasoning. And I think he would be very averse to facing that sort of thing, and for good reason, because I don't think that he could survive it nearly as easily as he could survive going and apologizing.
Maybe. I still think that I'm less interested in this particular instance giving him more airtime with which to work out that issue, and rather with giving airtime to people who disagree with that and want to bring a different perspective to it.
Right.
But I guess I'd have to, I think I may, would maybe have to ponder some other examples. Fodder for a future blogging heads, we will go down and
indeed
see who needs to apologize for what. Are there any other last things that we should wrap up? Any lightning round topics we want to run through and do thumbs up, thumbs down on?
You know, I don't have any, but maybe there's something else interesting at South by Southwest that is going on. I'm just, you know, sitting in my home office, whereas you've got all of the exciting cool fodder going on all around.
It is very exciting. I think maybe I'll just leave it at that. I mean, the beauty of these conferences is just forcing people, you know, to up on a stage and having them have to defend their ideas quickly. So.
Indeed. Well, have a good time at the rest of the conference, and I hope we do it again sometime. It was fun.
Absolutely. Thanks as always, Connor.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.